T. Farnsworth, Mormon Visionary, a paper given by Elma G. Farnsworth, author of Distant Vision, Romance and Discovery on an Invisible Frontier. Mrs. Philo T. Farnsworth lives here in Salt Lake City, and she wrote on her biographical sketch that she is largely self-educated. She was a lab technician and secretary to her husband, Philo T. Farnsworth, for most of her life, and has worked in his businesses. She, in addition to the book Distant Vision, Romance and Discovery on an Invisible Frontier, she has published other articles. She has four sons, Philo Taylor and Kenneth Gardner, who are deceased, Russell Seymour, who is a musician in New York City, and Kent Morgan, who is president of Pemberley Kent Publishers. She also wrote a little interesting paragraph about her heritage. I am descended from a Mayflower passenger. All eight of my grandparents were early Mormon pioneers, including Jonathan Oldham Duke, first mayor of Provo, and Bernard Snow, one of the legislators who helped draft the Utah Constitution. He was an actor who helped in the founding of the Old Salt Lake Theater. G.G. Elias Gardner arrived here with Brigham Young. He was a patriarch. So she has a rich heritage. I just wanted to mention that about a month ago I was talking to Leonard Arrington, and he is the one who recommended this book to me, and it has been a really rich experience to read this book. And also Eugene England has written an article in This People magazine on Mrs. Farnsworth's book, and it has just been delightful. In fact, it's one of those books that lives with you every day. I'm just constantly thinking of concepts and experiences she has written. And it's a pleasure for me to welcome Pam Farnsworth to Sunstone and deliver this paper.
Thank you. Can you see how to turn this on?
Just where it says on.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah, it's on.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to see all of you. This isn't a mic here, is it? So can you all hear me? Thank you. The question is often asked, how could a 15-year-old boy possibly conceive an idea as complex as that of electronic television? Well, RCA said that was impossible, and they used this to as a defense when my husband challenged them in 1934, because they were always claiming that Drs. Warwick and of RCA was the first inventor of television. Well, they found out that it was possible because Philo T. Farnsworth did it, and he got his first ideas about it when he was 13. He read in a magazine about spinning discs, and he decided that was entirely too clumsy, and if you could get a disc spinning fast enough to give you high resolution, it might be dangerous. It could really explode at those high speeds. So he had just found out about the electron. And he said, I'm going to train electrons to do this. And that's what he proceeded to do. But it was a year before, in thinking about this, he knew that he had to have books. There were no libraries, and his family had been poor, and they couldn't afford books and magazines. So he knew that he had to earn the money to do this. Well, he saw in one of those magazines that he found in the attic of the place they rented in Idaho. Now, he was born in Utah, in Beaver, Utah. But I think possibly the best way to go is start at the beginning, because he did have an auspicious beginning. As his father was hitching up the horses to go and fetch the midwife for his wife, who was about to deliver a baby, his first wife, who was dead, appeared to him and told him that this was a very special spirit that was being given to them in this baby, and to expect great things of him, and much care must be taken of his rearing. And this was something that his father, Lewis Edwin Farnsworth, and his mother, Serena Bastian Farnsworth, kept to themselves. I learned about it after my husband had died. A cousin had been at a celebration in Beaver when we came out for their centennial. And Phil's mother was there, and she had told her about this because Elder Peterson was speaking at the same podium as my husband was, and she said it gave her such a thrill to see her son speaking at the same meeting as one of the apostles. And so this was in a letter to me after he had died. Lewis had served a two-year mission in the southeast, and this was at the time when without purse or script meant just that. And it was very rough going down there at that time. But he was a very devout missionary and brought the word to many people. So this was he and Serena took this very seriously. The baby was named Philo Taylor Farnsworth for Lewis's father, who was one of the early Mormons that came across the plains at the time of Brigham Young. He was the first mayor of Pleasant Grove and the first bishop who usually a group of people were assigned and a person assigned to be a bishop over them. And they were sent to a certain location to build a town, and that's how they got this whole valley under cultivation, most of it. And so he went to Pleasant Grove, and from there he went to help build the state house in Fillmore, the first state house. And then they gave him the job of taking the group to Beaver and making a town there. And he was later a district judge, which was it was then a territory. It took in part of Nevada and Arizona and Utah, and he was a judge there until he died. Philo was born on August 19th in the log cabin where his grandfather had built for his grandmother, and his father had big plans for the family, but they never seemed to quite pan out. Looks like we're going to have pictures after all. We could have the pictures after I finish the talk, I think. It would be just as well. It won't interrupt too much. When Philo was a little fellow, about 2 1/2, President Joseph F. Smith was at a meeting in St. George, and his father was there. And after the meeting, his father was standing there talking to President Smith, and Philo was tugging at his trousers trying to get his attention. And he had, President Smith picked him up and put him on his shoulder, and he said, I want you to know that you can expect great things from this young man. And this type of thing came up so many times. Philo demonstrated a photographic memory at 3 when his father took him to see his first steam engine. His father was running stage between Medina and St. George area, and he had told his little boy about these engines that pulled the train. So he took him one day, and of course at first he was very frightened when this big monster rolled in with the hissing and the screeching and all this. And but the engineer saw this and asked if he wouldn't like to come up and see how he ran this thing. And so his fear turned to interest, because he was interested in everything like that. He went home late that night and made a detailed drawing of this engine, because his father had then gone around the outside and showed him the various parts and explained them to him. So this probably, since the first family of Louis and Amelia's, there were two older boys and two older girls. And, of course, they made a big fuss over Philo because he had been able to do this. And they brought books whenever they found something about an inventor and told him, and he decided that inventors were pretty nice people to be, and he hoped he could be one day. In Utah, Lewis wasn't able to, he was going to farm a 120-acre piece of land, which was all sagebrush then, but it took more capital than he could muster, and he lost that. Anyway, he was clearing a helping clear some land in on the Ute Reservation in the foothills of the Uinta Mountains, and he built, he and his brother and their and nephews built a log cabin for his family to stay in. By then, they had two younger brothers and two younger sisters than Phil. And as we called him Phil later, he took that, he stopped using the O after the children in school started calling him Fido. And so one night, sitting at the table doing his lessons, it was winter and there had been a fresh snow, he heard a scratch at the window, and he looked up, and there was a mountain lion with its paws pressed against that flimsy window. Well, Serena was sitting by him doing her eternally handy knitting, she was always having to do, and she whispered, "Don't move. Just pray." Well, he'd been praying, but he had heard a story about a man staring a lion down in a jungle, and he was trying to do the same thing. And he held the gaze of this lion for so long, he was afraid that he was going to fail, but the lion disappeared. Well, the next morning, of course, they didn't sleep much that night. The next morning he went out to see how the animals fared, and the cow hadn't been harmed, and the pigs were squealing hungrily for their breakfast, but there were tracks showing that the lion had circled the corral twice, and he was very grateful that they'd been spared. When he was 11, he drove the third wagon, the three covered wagon train, to Idaho. His father decided he would, well, he had brothers and sisters up there, and they wanted him to come up and help in the beet industry up there. And his one brother, Louis, Albert, had this 240-acre ranch. He raised racehorses. The Farnsworth horses were quite famous up there. And so they asked Lewis to bring his family and work on the farm with them, or to help them on the ranch, rather. The first thing that happened there is that he found out they had electricity. In those days, there was no electricity in the country, countryside, but they had a Delco power generator. Well, it wasn't long before he learned how this thing worked, and he was the only one on the place that could keep it running, so they called him the engineer of the Delco generator. But the next thing that was even equally important to him is that he found a stack of science and popular radio magazines in the attic of this cottage, or the bungalow where they lived. And this was like manna to this bookstore boy, because he knew there was a lot out there he needed to know and no way to get at it. And this is where he read about spinning discs, and he read an article by Albert Einstein on relativity. Well, at that time, American scientists, there was one especially, can't say his name at the moment, in California, who said that Einstein's theory would not, it was not true, it was not right. So Einstein had written a very simplified description of how his theory worked. And Philo saw this, and it seemed perfectly logical to him, and he memorized it, and this was part of his thinking from then on, and probably had a lot to do with a lot of the things that he did. Now, his problem was to buy books, so he saw this contest listed in the magazine about gadgets for enhancing the use of a motor car. You know, they were pretty crude in those days, and so he decided, well, maybe he could win this. If he, the prize was $25, and of course in those days, to a farm boy, $25 was quite a bit. So he kept thinking about this, and all that summer he rode a haymower, a team-drawn haymower, and he had a lot of time to think, but he couldn't wait to do his chores after he finished his work in the field so he could get up and read his magazines. But he found out how to build a motor. He found a burned-out motor and rewound the armature, which is, if any of you are, know anything about those things, it's a little difficult to do. He rewound this armature and made a motor because his mother had the first time she had been released from the corrugated washboard. And it was an early washing machine, and you had to push and pull the handle. You must have seen one of those. And he had to do it. Well, so he hooked this motor up to his mother's washing machine, and it ran. So he was relieved of that job. He also tried to hook it up to her sewing machine, which she made all the family clothes. But she decided that her foot power was more manageable, so she asked him to take that off. So he decided that, well, maybe he could use the electron to figure out something. He knew you could make magnetize metal, and he thought maybe if he could magnetize a car ignition, then you'd probably have to have a magnetized key to open it. Well, he got so excited about this. On this day, he was using a cultivator with a three-horse team, and his father was a little worried about letting him do this because he'd never used three horses before, and the one horse was a little skittish. But Philo said, "Oh, I can do it. Don't worry about it." But he was so involved in his thinking that he had dropped the rein of the skittish horse and didn't know it. His father was impressed. He was working in the field nearby to come and see how he was doing. And when he saw that rain dragging along in the dirt and Philo obviously lost in thought, he was his blood ran cold because there'd been a man in the area the year before who had a similar situation, and the horses had been frightened and run away and thrown the rider into the discs, and he'd been cut to pieces. And so he had to make a very steady, careful approach to this rig to get the rain. He got there, and that was the first that Philo realized his predicament. But he was more interested in telling his father about his new idea than he was his own safety. He jumped off and started to tell his father, and his father said, "Philo, you could have been killed." And he said, I know you must have a good idea, but I'm not interested now." So it was that later that night that he, when Philo left the table early and went up to his magazines, he followed him up and he said, "I am really interested in hearing your idea." And when he heard it, he said, "Well, do you think this would win over a whole nation of contenders?" And Philo said, "Well, it's worth a try." So he sent it in, and of course they wrote back that that he had he would have to have a working model and have it notarized that it worked. And so the only notary in town was the banker, and he went down there and explained it and showed it to him. And the banker called the newspaper across the street and had them come over, and they took a picture of him. I had that picture. I was going to show here, but it's in our display out. I find it is. So anyway, when the money came, though, it took so long to get there that he was not in that bad a shape. His music teacher had organized a four-piece orchestra for playing for dances. There was no music for dances up there in Rigby. And Philo had been playing the violin for about 6 years, and he was pretty good at it. So he was the violinist. They were getting $5 a piece each Friday night or Saturday night. And so he used the money to get his first long pants, because he was then a deacon and played in an orchestra, and it was not befitting that he should wear knee pants anymore. Now, it was not until the next year, and strangely enough, he was using a disc again with two horses only. His father had bought a farm, and he was tilling the ground for a potato patch, and the ground was a little moist. He'd made a few rows, and he turned at the end of the row and looked back over his rows. What his problem was is that he couldn't figure out how he knew he could turn light into electricity, and he could turn electricity back into light. But he didn't know how he was going to scan this. But he all at once saw exactly how he could do this, and he saw these rows, even rows that he'd made. You could scan it like you'd read a page of print on a paper. Even though you had to take this thing apart, a point of light at a time, and you had to put it back together in this form, you could do it a line at a time. So that got him so excited that that he could hardly stand to finish the work that day to tell his father about it. When he did, his father said, "Well, I don't understand all you've told me, son, but it's all right to keep your head in the clouds, but be sure you keep your feet firmly planted on the ground." And he told me that, he reminded me of that many times during his life. He was 15 when he got up courage enough to tell his chemistry teacher, Destin Tolman, about this. And later in 1934, when he had petitioned the patent office to decide between he and Latimer Zworykin, and who was really the first inventor of television, because his idea was that he could sell licenses to use his patents, because he had six of the most vital patents of television, and finance his other work that way. But he couldn't do that as long as they kept saying that Zworykin was the man. And so we have a copy of that ruling. It was about 48 pages, I think. And it said that since Zworykin had filed a patent in 1923, but his tube was not workable. It had organic things in it, and you could not pump a vacuum in a tube with organic material in it. And whereas Philo Farnsworth had been, he got his first transmission in 1927, and this was 1934. And this was the year that he had his first big public demonstration of television to the Franklin Institute. Philo had finished 2 years of high school in that 1 year, and he felt he didn't have any more time for high school. So he wanted to go to the BYU, but he had to earn money. So during this summer, he had completed a course on an electrician's course from the National Radio Institute of Washington, and he got a job as a junior electrician to got money for college, and at the same time he signed up for four major courses from the U of U as not to lose time. He got down to the Brigham Young University in the fall of 1923, and the next January, his father died of pneumonia. And this just really shattered his world, because he felt that he was so near to making it easy for his parents, and then his father was gone. He had done a lot of soul searching during this time, but one of his professors at BYU recommended that he read As a Man Thinketh by James Allen, and also the essays of Ralph Waldo Emerson. He did this, and they made a big impression on him. Actually, his whole life was set up around these things. He felt that Allen's As a Man Thinketh in his heart, so is he. It was very profound. And in fact, he recommended these books to all of the people who worked for him, and of course they were required reading for his sons. My family had moved to Provo that same year, and Phil's sister Agnes and I signed up for high school together and became very close friends. And it was not until the next fall that I met Phil through Agnes. But he found out that my brother played the trombone. In fact, my brother and I played the piano, and we were playing for dances in Jensen. There was no music for dances down there either. And so he asked if he could come over and jam it up with us, and this got to be a regular Saturday afternoon thing. But he and Cliff got jobs together, and they became very close friends. Phil had taken his ideas to a number of people with money, thinking that he could get backing for it. And he always met with the attitude that you know, he was wool gathering. It was just an absolutely impossible thing. And actually, his professors at the BYU had told him that he was trying the impossible. So, but he wouldn't believe them. He finally got backing from two California people who had come up to organize the Salt Lake Community Chest. And by that time, Phil and I were engaged, and so he called me, and he said, "Can you be married in 3 days?" And I said, "Well, no, I can't, not in 3 months, because my mother died not long before, and I was the oldest one at home." But when our parents found out how this was, they decided that they'd get behind it and help us. So we were married. We spent 3 months in Hollywood, and George Everson, who was one of the campaigners and had invested first in us, in Phil, got the ear of some bankers in San Francisco. "I'm going to have to move faster here, I'm sure." So anyway, he was given $25,000. He would have a budget of $1,000 a month, and this would have to take care of salaries and everything. And he went into a bare loft, and 2 weeks within a year he had produced a one line picture transmission of television. And when Dr. Terman of Stanford saw this, you know, he was another one that told him, "You were trying to do the impossible." And he said, "Well, I'll just have to learn to recognize genius when I see it." So since he had such a small budget, he got Cliff to come and help, and I was there with willing hands, and they taught me to use the precision spot welder, and I was making tube elements and and keeping books and making his drawings and whatever else I could. But there were just the three of us until the last 3 months of that year. He was having a lot of trouble with the amplifier, because amplifiers in those days were entirely inadequate to television, and they were able to get an amplifier. After this happened, he got his family to come down, and his mother and sisters were very active in the church. In fact, Bishop Nalder, who was bishop of the ward down there, recognized the leadership qualities of Serena and his mother, and put her in as the president of the Relief Society, and she went on to be the stake president, and her daughter took it over after she was gone. And they needed to build a new chapel. Well, of course, the church would pay half of it if the ward members would pay the other half. But this was not going to be possible. Well, we had just organized our first Television Incorporated, and Phil had he was the largest stockholder, and he gave Bishop Nalder stock that he wasn't able to sell it just right at that moment, but he was in time to help them with the chapel, and they got their nice chapel. We often talked about coming back to Utah and be married in the temple, but it took us a long time to get back here. It was not until 68 that we got back here and bought a home on holiday and went through the temple. I was so happy that we did that. Phil's first licensee was Philco. They were then the largest retail sellers of radio. And, of course, RCA had radio just tied up in knots. You couldn't build anything like electrical without parts from RCA. So Philco thought that if they got Farnsworth in there to get them started on television, they'd get around RCA. Well, they had a very hush-hush project on the top floor, and no one was allowed in there but the top three executives of the company. And but when they got their license, their experimental license, and started broadcasting, of course, they've been able to receive RCA's broadcast because they were just across the river from Camden, New Jersey, where the RCA labs were. And so RCA told Philco, well, you either dump Farnsworth or you won't have a license with us anymore, which they couldn't build. Well, Farnsworth even had to have a license from RCA to build a television set for all the little people. So the year after we went to Philadelphia to set up Philco, by that time, we had two sons, Philo Jr. and Kenny. Kenny was just 13 months old, and he got a strep infection, and there was just nothing you could do about it in those days. And he passed away. Well, Phil vowed on his deathbed that he was going to make it so that no other babies would have to go through this. And couldn't take the time away from Philco, but he knew some doctors in the University of Pennsylvania Medical Division, and he got a group of pre-med students to work under him, and they did produce a serum that was effective. But it wasn't long before the sulfa drugs and the streptomycins and things of that sort came out, and they had such a broad spectrum that they were much better, and that took care of it even more. Well, our pediatrician came to Phil one day and said, we have to save some of these preemies. There are too many dying. And they said, if anyone can do it, you can. So they sat down, and he worked out an incubator that would reproduce the environment in the womb, so that the baby would have a better chance. They built 8 of these, and I guess the word, the name Isolette is still around. And I know they, I meet people all the time saying that they'd been saved, or someone in their family had been saved with this, and it's a very nice feeling. But losing Kenny just shook us to the core and almost broke us up because we couldn't talk about it. And but it was in time we realized that where we were headed, and we were able to get this. It took us some time to get all the hurt talked out, but we were even closer than ever before. since RCA was saying that Vladimir Zworykin was the inventor of television, no one dared take a license from Farnsworth because RCA had said, well, you know, you either deal with us or Farnsworth. So Phil's next licensee was Baird of London and Fernse of Berlin. In 1936, Berlin or Fernse broadcast the World Olympics that was there using Farnsworth equipment. In 1939, David Sarnoff made a big splash by announcing the television to the public. Well, of course, he was using Farnsworth patents to do this, and he didn't even have a license. But he finally, that fall, he did take a license, and then everyone got on the bandwagon, and they all took licenses under Farnsworth. In November, Baird gave us an SOS and said that they really had to have Phil over there. Phil had been working very hard, and he didn't feel like going, but he said, well, if we can take a cruise boat and take our time, and I can bring Pim with me, I'll come. So we did that, and we got over to London, and it was about 10 days before they got everything straightened out there. And Phil said, I am just so worn out. I'm going to have to get with his son. If we go home, it'll have to be Florida or California. Why don't we go down to the Riviera, the French Riviera? So that's what we did. While we were there, he was under doctor's care there, and the doctor wanted to put him in the hospital, and he says, no, we won't go to a hospital. But what we will do is we'll rent a car, an open car, and we'll have our lunch packed, and we'll see the country while I'm resting. So that's what we did. But while we were there, the Crystal Palace burned in London. That's where Baird had their license, their studios. So we went to Berlin because they hadn't been making their payments as they should, and we found that Hitler wasn't allowing any money out of the country. And furthermore, to our chagrin, we found that they weren't letting people out of the country either if they were if they were scientists. Our sailings were canceled 3 times, and finally, Phil told Dr. Gerritz, president of Fernse, that he was going to the American consulate. And Dr. Fernse said, you let me handle this. So they called and they said, you be ready at 11 o'clock tonight. We're going to come and get you and put you on that boat train, which we had to take to get down to Hamburg, take the boat. And they did come. There were 2 from Baird in London, and there were about 8 that were surrounded us and spirited us out of the hotel and took us and stayed with us on the train. Dr. Gerritz brought a box of German chocolates. And I couldn't find a piece of paper. I wanted them all to sign something in it. So this wrapper off the chocolates, I still have it in my file with all their signatures on it. While we were there, of course, we could see that war was imminent there, and Phil said, I can see that we're not going to get commercial television until after this war is over. And his patents were so early that they would start to expire in the early 50s. And so he helped set standards for with the other workers in television and just went to Maine and would not let anyone say anything about television. And in fact, one reason he's not so well written up in encyclopedias is because the American Encyclopedia wrote and asked him if he'd do the article on television, and he threw it in the wastebasket and didn't even answer. And he was just heartbroken, I guess. He hadn't. He saw that all of his work was for nothing. He had seen an odd thing happen in one of his electron multiplier tubes, and he had to explain this. He finally decided that it was atoms fusing in that, and what this led him into working on fusion. By the time he got his math to the point where he proved it to himself, he did talk to Dr. Einstein about it. And Dr. Einstein said, well, I was headed in that direction, but he said, when they drop bombs, I wouldn't contribute further. And but he said, continue and formalize your math and publish it. But Phil knew that Dr. Einstein had taken years to get his theory of relativity recognized. And he said, I have neither the time, because his health wasn't good, nor the money to do that. So I'll just make one of these things and they'll have to disprove it. All through this time, Phil, so many things had happened that he couldn't explain otherwise. He said, well, we're on a guided tour, and so if things aren't going like you think it should, just realize that it's for a purpose, and don't fight it. So, let's see. You mean I can talk for that long, or do we have just that much? I thought we... Oh, okay. I'm nearing... trying to figure out how to get everything in here. In 1953, we came out here. The Arch Madsen was president of the Utah Broadcasters Association, and he invited Phil out here for a testimonial dinner in Salt Lake. And we came out, and all of the old professors from the BY and everyone that Phil knew was there, and it was just a great experience. And Phil said, well, I want Justin Tolman and his wife on the stand. Well, I got to meet them the first time at that time. But then he went down to the Brigham Young University, and then Apostle David O. McKay introduced him. And it was in 1967 that President McKay decided that they should make a documentary on Phil. So they sent a man, we were in Maine at that time, and they sent a man up to see if this were possible. But I'd had a heart attack. I was grounded. I couldn't take a trip in any way. So Phil said, well, if you can wait till next spring, we'll do that. So we went down and stayed in the winter at Sanibel Island off the coast of Fort Myer and came out here the next May. While we were here, Phil said, you know, I'd like to finish this work at the BYU because it would give them a lot of credit, and I'd really like it that way. So they were interested in it, too. But after talking to the BYU, Phil said, how would you like to, you think it's time to come back to Utah now? I said, I don't say it if you don't mean it, because I had much of my family here and his too. And he said, well, if we bought a house before we leave, would you believe it? And so we bought a house. We came back and organized a company for this purpose, but ITT would not release the patents. The best they would do is to give him a non-exclusive license, and he would then fund it and do it, and they'd have it. But he had told them before that he was not going to finish Fusion unless he had a say in how it was introduced, because it was going to be a terrific upheaval in the economy if it was not handled right. And so with that, and the fact that the underwriter that was supposed to put a stock issue through for us had lost their license before on a previous issuance that they were trying to get. And by the time we find that out, we'd put everything we had into the company to save it. And it was too much for Phil, and he died. The morning after he was buried, I was concentrating, I guess, thinking I could telecommunicate or something, and a voice came into my head and said that Phil, I had to let him go, that he had work to do, and I hadn't finished my work here on Earth. And at that same time, I knew what that work here on Earth was, and I was at peace. So, was it a guided tour or not? I'll leave you that for you to decide. And we'll can we show some pictures if we have time for that? Now, we can either show pictures or we can have a question and answer. Pardon? Okay. All right. You said it. I think Kent will take care of this. Good question. Before he even got his first picture, he used to tell us what television would do. He said, you'll be able to get an education over television. You will be able to see movies at home over television. And news items will be seen in the home as it's happening, and that you just and furthermore, he said it's going to make the world a smaller place. And I said, well, he had told me that you could only broadcast television in a straight line. So I said, how do you get beyond that? How to get it over the ocean? He said, well, we'll have captive balloons or something. But you see, he had a big hand in the space program and guidance in these satellites, and this was his balloon. But he felt that always that programming would be what the people demanded they get. And now the fact that some factions speak louder than those who don't like what's on, I think it's up to us to speak louder, make our voices heard. Because if we don't buy the products that are advertised with a program that we don't agree with, then it's our fault, right? But he didn't think it was being used to a good advantage.
When did it actually get on the market in the United States?
It was about 1948. Oh, we had a good enough picture. We had an experimental license, as did RCA, and we were broadcasting. And there were a number of other broadcasters around the country who were, but on experimental basis. They decided that they wanted war bonds to be bought instead of television sets, so they wouldn't get licenses before the war. Oh, this is the log cabin where he was born near Beaver, Utah. This is when he was at the BYU. He's in the middle there, in back. Right here. I'm tired. He was supposed to be a twin of the boy next to him, and they played violins in this drama. But he took drama from the BYU because he felt this is one of the things that he was a little shy about talking, and it might give him more experience. Well, anyway, right the top floor up there is where we got the first picture that was transmitted. It took us a few years, but we got the state has a plaque on the corner there, a monument, saying this is where the first television broadcast was made.
Where was that now?
It was on Green Street in San Francisco. Can you see it well enough at all? That was spinning disc television.
Well, didn't General Sarnoff have pavilion in the
World War II? Oh, 39, yes. Yes.
Using Farnsworth patents?
Right. Yes, they did. They had electronic television. That's Phil and I in the laboratory.
Being blown around here.
Now, this was the first article on television, and a picture of me that the first transmission.
There's a thing that you
can enlarge them. Well, you can just barely see it's a face, but that was the first published picture of a received picture.
Well, now you had to turn your face because the lights were so bright. Is that wasn't that the case?
Yes, the lights. It was an arc light. It was very very bright. That was when we had our 1934 broadcast display to the public in Franklin Institute. And he took a picture of the moon. He had the television up on the roof one night, and it made a big splash in the papers. Oh, this is the executives of the Franklin Institute. And Phil on the left with one of his men showing some of the equipment. Now, in 1936, we had a laboratory, a transmitter, an experimental transmitter and studio. This was inside of the studio. Someone has told...
This was the building.
Yes, that's the building. With the laboratory group.
Someone, no antennas yet, though.
Well, yes.
So
they, but I couldn't find the picture of it. It was a big antenna. There was another picture with it in it. But this is when the Institute of... Indiana Institute of Technology gave him a doctorate. And later, the BYU did the same in 1968. Barbara, let's see if that one will come over. This is the time that Apostle Peterson and Phil. And the man on the right is Taylor Farnsworth, and he was the mayor of Beaver at that time. It was a cousin of Phil's. I think that one is where he found a way to... Yeah.
Another one.
That was the electron microscope. He built the first electron microscope to see what was the matter of his photo surfaces that weren't smooth enough, and he could watch it being put down molecule by molecule.
Someone, I think, at that point suggested that he develop that and forget television.
Right, that was a man from GE. He said, I don't know about your television, but this is a really important idea. And this is when he was chosen as one of America's top 10 men under 40. And
this is,
of course, there's
9 months before RCA would sign the license.
Right. Lou Gehrig, for baseball, Ernest Lawrence for his cyclotron, Fulton Lewis News, William S. Paley, who started NBC.
CBS,
yes. Perry Pipkin, who was the youngest Chamber of Commerce president, and Philip Reed of New York City, chairman of the General Electric, and Harold Stassen, the youngest governor.
Spencer Tracy.
Can't
forget.
Yes, Hollywood. Wait, there was another one. Wells. Herman Wells. Now, he's a... I think he was a microbiologist in the University of Indiana. This is the era when Phil was working on space science things, and his iotron tube... Farnsworth iotron. Can you read that?
Projector indicator.
Mm-hmm.
This is would be the beginnings of air traffic control.
Mm-hmm. This is a unit. One of the things it did is you could control the airflow because of the pips on the screen. You could hold in place. It was a memory tube. You could keep it in to direct traffic. It's probably all. Oh, there's a fusion thing there. This is when he was inducted into the the Beehive Hall of Fame. The 1982. Of course, in 1983, he got a postage stamp with his face on it. And the next year, he was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in Arlington. These are pictures of Phil and his fuser that he called his fusion apparatus.
It was not a year after this picture was taken of him that he was generating a star,
mm-hmm.
a real star in the center of that tube.
Right.
I know because I saw it. I was there. I think that's it.
Are there any more questions? We have. I finally finished the book on his life, and we have it for sale out here on the table. Thank you.
I'd like to introduce someone. Dr. Barneson. Could you come up and bring your statue? We didn't have time for him to deliver a comment. And
oh, I'm sorry.
No. This was fun. This is what we wanted. Dr. Barneson is the one who spearheaded the movement to have the...
Kent.
Yes.
Just about done here. Dr. Barneson is the one who spearheaded the movement to have the Philo Farnsworth statue put in the United States Capitol on May 2nd, and then in the Utah State Capitol on July 24th. And this is the statue here. And Dr. Barneson really has an exciting story about the children, and some of those children went back to Washington. And I'm sure many of you saw it on the TV and in the newspaper. So we wanted to see if you can talk, see a couple words.
They're ready to go.
Okay.
Oh, are they?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No. And if any of you want to ask some questions, there is not going to be another session in this room, and so you're welcome to stay for a few minutes. But first, we'd just like to thank Mrs. Feinberg and her son Kent for this wonderful session.
Thank you.
You don't want to leave?
No.
Well, I'll tell you how we got involved with this. Each year, my little elementary school, I'm an elementary school principal, and each year our little elementary school would do a little legislative project. We made the state insect a honeybee, which was kind of...